Okay, so this topic, the question of can or should a religious soldier switch with a non-religious soldier on Shabbos, which is the exact same halakhic question as whether a religious doctor should switch with a non-religious doctor for a Shabbos shift or not. And that question could go either you shouldn't do anything, or you have to switch, or you can't switch, right? All those possibilities are open. I like the question not just because, you know, it's a fun halakhic question, but because it's one of the few cases I know where the classic halakhic literature that exists on it is basically philosophical literature, is post-Gim trying to formulate philosophical principles based on the Gemara, but it's but you know, it's there's a very, very strong philosophical overtone to the conversation. So before we get to their positions, let's see the Gemara that they base themselves on. You'll see why I call this philosophical. So here I've you know, organized the Makor sheet a little bit differently, and I've divided the Gemara into seven parts, into seven stages, with the English paralleling the Hebrew stages. And the Gemara really is a analysis of what is the nature of sin, right? Why is sin wrong? Right, so before we even look at the Gemara, right? Why do you think sin is wrong? And what's wrong with, you know, violating one of the Averot in the Torah? It's a question we don't normally ask, but why is it wrong?
Because we're told to do the mitzvot. If you don't do them, there is consequences, and that's why you don't do it.
So part of it is punishment, but still, what's wrong about it? Like, at a fundamental level, we're not supposed to do it, and there are consequences, but why are there consequences? Like, what is it exactly we're being punished for?
It's like denying Hashem.
And so one is that it's not the sin itself, it's what the sin represents, right? That we're rebelling, we're denying God, we're, you know, flagrant about his will, right? That's one possibility. The other possibility, right, we can always ask the same thing about law, right? Why is it wrong to violate the law?
Well, there's an order to the world, and that's what law is. Law is something that orders society, and when you violate law, then you violate the norms of society, and then you can get chaos.
Right. So that's another possibility that it's right that it causes sort of a breakdown of order. But like, you know, let's think about
goes one rank down.
Right, and it you know affects all of sort of the moral level of society. But let's think about different laws, just secular laws. Right. If I asked you why can't you drive, you know, above the speed limit? Right, or why can't you above, you know, let's say the speed limit is 60 kilometers an hour, why can't you drive above 60? You would say not because it's intrinsically wrong to drive above 60, but because there's a rule and you're breaking it, but there's nothing fundamentally wrong with it. But if I asked you why is it wrong to murder or to steal, you'd say not because it's illegal because it's wrong. Right, so there are different types of laws. There are laws which are wrong because they're wrong and law just formalizes them. And then there are things which are only wrong because the law says so. Right? You're not punished for going over the speed limit because you did something morally corrupt. You did it because that's the law. So the same question really exists by sin, right? Is God punishing us because there's something fundamentally wrong about the actions? Or is it that God said so, and therefore by violating it, we're violating the law, we're violating his word, but there's nothing fundamental about this act that's wrong. And again, we could distinguish between different types of sins. So that's really the question that the Gemara is getting at in a sort of interesting way. So the Gemara is building off a pasuk at the end of Sefer Bamidbar. So the psukim there are talking about the ability of a husband, right, under certain circumstances, we're talking about a young woman, 12 and a half, who makes a vow, and her husband can nullify it. So the pasuk at one point says that Isha Afiram, her husband has nullified it, Vashem Yislachla. And Hashem will forgive her. And it's a little bit odd, right? What is Hashem forgiving the woman for? It sounds like she's violated the vow, and God will forgive her because the vow had been nullified. So that's what the Gemara is trying to figure out. So in Aleph, right, and you can look at Aleph or A, right, Tana Rabbanan, Isha Hafeiram Vashem Yislachla. The pasuk says that her husband has nullified her vow and Hashem shall forgive her. Who are we talking about? Be Isha Shehefer La Ba'ala, Vihi Lo Yadah Akasuv Midaber. It's where a woman made a vow, violated her vow, but didn't realize that her husband had already nullified the vow. So therefore, she didn't actually do something wrong, because at the moment when she quote-unquote violated her vow, the vow no longer existed, but she was rebelling against God because she thought what she was doing was wrong. Right? So what we've done now is we've isolated these two components of sin. Right? We said there are really two reasons why sin could be wrong, and most sins have both. You're violating, you're going against what God said, and you're doing something intrinsically wrong. You're doing the sin. But here we've managed to isolate it, and the only thing you've done is rebelled against God, but you haven't actually done anything wrong. You thought you were, but you didn't. And yet the pasuk says, Hashem yislach la, Hashem has to forgive her, which implies that simply doing something and thinking it's wrong is already wrong. So the pasuk says, Shehi tzricha kaparo slicha, that she needs atonement and forgiveness. So in now in Bet, Rabbi Akiva derives from that. Ukshahaya magir, Rabbi Akiva, it's a pasuk zeh yaboche. So when Rabbi Akiva would come to this pasuk, he would cry, and he would say, if someone who meant to eat pig, but ate sheep, meaning he meant to eat not kosher, but he ate kosher, the pasuk says, ta'un kaparo slicha, he needs forgiveness, implying that he's violated something, that simply the will to do something wrong is wrong. So someone who both intends and accomplishes sin, how much worse is that? Because of both components of sin. Then in 3, similarly, and this is actually the flip side, is v'lo yadav ashem v'nasav ono. So we have a category of karbanot, of sacrifices, that you have to bring if you violate an avera, if you violate a sin by accident. So there, we've isolated it in the opposite direction. Because now you've done something wrong. The act you've done is sin, but you didn't intend to. So we've isolated the other component of sin, meaning the action, the objective component, but we've taken away the evil intent. And there, you need a korban, right? You need to bring a sacrifice. So the Gemara says, "Umashin mishin eskaven lalos biado basar tleh." If someone meant to eat kosher, v'ala biado basar chazir, and instead ate not kosher, kagon chaticha safek shel shuman v'safek shel chelev, like someone who ate something that he wasn't sure if it was kosher or not kosher fat, omar krav v'nasavo no. The psukim say that you shall carry your sin. If you mean to eat pig, and you do, how much more so are you going to need forgiveness? And then line 4, stage 4, is Isi ben Yehuda Omer, he limits that case and says, V'lo yadav Hashem v'nasavo, no. And here, the background to this is there's two types of cases where you could be unsure whether you violated a sin. One would be where you have one piece of meat and you're not sure if it's kosher or not kosher. The other one is where you have two pieces of meat in front of you. You know one of them is kosher and one of them is not kosher, and you eat one of them. So in halacha, that's considered worse because you know for sure that there's something usher in the picture, right? And nevertheless, you're going ahead. So he brings in that case, umashim niskaven lalos biado basar tlev alo biado basar chazir kagod shtei chatichos achas shel chelev achas shel shuman. If one who ate the wrong thing when there were two pieces, v'nasav ono, he has to, it's considered sin. V'lo miskaven lalos biado basar chazir v'alo biado basar chazir. If you mean to eat big and you do, alachas kama and al davar ze yidavu hadavim. And for this, let those who are going to grieve, grieve. And the Gemara now says, as if it weren't clear already what it was doing, it makes it clear that what it's doing is isolating the different components of sin. So in 5, in stage, hey, the kol hani lamali, why do you need all these three stages? Because tzrichet, di'i tana gabe isha, if you'd only taught the case of the neder, of the vow, hasam hu davai kapar slicha, there you need forgiveness, mishum demi'i karal isura ichavein, because you had negative intent, aval chaticha safik shal chelev safik shal shuman, where you ate the wrong thing, dilahetera ichavein, where you meant to eat the permitted thing, lo bai kapar slicha, so I would have thought you don't need forgiveness, v'it marhadan, stage 6, and if you said the second case, meaning the case where you violated something by accident, de'ika isura, there is prohibited substance here, of isha de hefer la baila, but in the case of the vow, de hetera, there is no prohibition here, lo tibay kaparas licha, right? So stage five is, I might have thought you only need forgiveness when you have intent. Stage six is, I might think you only need forgiveness when you actually do something wrong objectively. The lesson is, no, both components of sin are independently sinful. And then seven is, v'yet marani tarte avamin hani trey, hu disagam lun kabarba uslicha. I might have thought that only in these two cases can you be forgiven, lo ikba yisura, because you're not flagrantly going against God's will, because, you know, here there's a prohibited and permitted substance. You know there's a prohibited thing and you go and eat it anyways. I might have thought that that's not regular kaparas licha, right? That's almost considered a full-blown prohibition. But there were the prohibitions in front of you. So you see that there's no difference. So what this Gemara does is it ends up isolating, right, what is sin. And it says, really, there are two components. And I might have thought that sin only exists when both components are present. When I mean to rebel against God and I did something which is objectively wrong. What the Gemara teaches you is that no, is that each element is sinful. It's wrong to rebel against God, even if you didn't actually do something, quote-unquote, wrong. And there's a problem with doing something wrong, even if you didn't rebel against God.
So action and intention.
Right.
You would have thought that action only and not intention. And this is telling you that both action individually and intention, or both combined.
Well, both combined for sure. But each of them independently is considered, quote unquote, sin, at least at some level. Now.
But the intention that is carried out as an action.
Yes.
Not if I say, you know what, I really want to go to McDonald's.
Correct. Right. The Gemara in Kiddushin explicitly says that if you have intent but you never do something, so then we assume you never would have gotten around to doing it. Like, you would have held back at the last moment. Right? But here, that's not the case. It's you thought you were violating. You thought you were doing something wrong. It's like a sting operation. Right? You really, right, it's, right, what, that's what a sting operation is. Right? You're not actually doing anything wrong. You're not actually buying drugs from an illegal drug cartel. Right, but you show that you're willing to go so far as to actually buy the drug or sell the drugs, so we punish you, even though nothing actually happened. Right, you weren't selling to a poor teenager; you were selling to an undercover cop. But we still punish you because the fact that you had the bad intent and went ahead and did something, we punish you because you allowed your intention to manifest itself in the real world through no fault of your own. You didn't succeed in violating the law. But we punish you anyway. So that's basically what it's saying, right? Yes, if you just have the intent but you don't actually do anything about it, then that's, you know, that's not what we're talking about. But when you actually implement it, so then that is a problem. Now, so I sort of understand, right, why we would consider it sinful to rebel against God even if you didn't do something objectively wrong, because you rebelled against God. But what about the flip side, right? Why is it that if I eat, you know, not kosher food, and I didn't realize that I was eating not kosher food, right? Why is that a problem, right? What is this magical "it is usser" component, right? That requires forgiveness, right? What is it about, right, accidental sin that requires forgiveness? Right, the Gemara just asserts that it is true, but it doesn't explain why. So, what do you think? Right, and this comes back to our same. Right, same sort of opening question, right? Right. So why would accidental sin be problematic?
It seems as though there's some sort of, you know, meta,
right. So
situation that gets messed up.
Right. So one possibility is to say that there is that sin has some more metaphysical reality, and therefore, when I violate a sin, even if I didn't mean to, and there's no rebellion, still I did something and. You know, the metaphysical worlds. The other possibility is to say,
if nothing happens, if I do the sin, even if I didn't mean to and nothing happens, I will end up doing it again because there was nothing happened to me. If I have to bring a korban or I have to do something about it, I feel sorry about it, then at least I know that I won't do it again.
Right, so that's like a different possibility, which is to say it's not that there was anything wrong, but that we need to create a disincentive, so we need to treat it as if it were wrong.
Exactly.
Right? Which is another possibility, which I actually didn't include in the sources, but that is another possibility. The Gemara has this interesting line that it says, with the case of karbanot, that you bring when you do a sin accidentally, the moment you become obligated is not when you do the sin, but when you find out you did the sin. Right? It's the critical moment is yidiyah. Right. And one way of reading that would be that you didn't actually do anything wrong. It's the knowledge I did something wrong that requires us to make you bring a karban. So that's a third possibility, which is that you didn't do anything wrong, but we need to create a disincentive. But the other possibility, right, if we come back to our original question, right, what is wrong about sin? There's the rebellion in it, and then there's the, you know, objective isser that's done, the objective prohibition that's violated. So what would be the equivalent of the first side for accidental sin? Right? What problem in your intent is there when you violate something accidentally? Or if we take it to sort of, you know, let's say secular law, right? Why is manslaughter a category, right? Right, there's homicide and there's, right, premeditated murder, but then there's manslaughter, right? Why is it a category?
I mean, I don't know if this is going to answer that, but your first question, there needs to be a scrupulousness that we engage in all the time.
Right, exactly. So the other possibility is to say that, you know, purposeful sins, the evil intent that exists is a rebellion. Accidental sins, it's not that you rebelled, but you did show sort of a flippant perspective towards the Avera. And right, if we come back to manslaughter, right, both components are there, right? On the one hand, you killed somebody. On the other hand, right, the language that we use, right, negligent homicide, right, is that homicide is not something you should take negligently. Human life is important, and you're actually liable, not just because you killed somebody, but because you were so, right, you were so flippant about human life, so we have to impose a penalty. So this is actually a machlokes between the Rambam and the Ramban. The Ramban actually suggests both. The Rambam takes one side clearly, but I just put the Ramban because he brings both. So this isn't two. So umahu chait, right? What is the sin of one who has sinned inadvertently? So he says, one is shel nizhar ba'atzma v'lo ha'yarei v'chareid al divrei ha'makom baruch hu. One is that he wasn't fearful and terrified of violating God's will. Shel yochav lo yaseh davar. To not do something, actually yivdok yafe yafe, until he checked v'yitgala lo ha'davar shehu mutar, and knew for sure that it was permitted. V'ra'ui lo lefig zeratav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's what he should have done, because this is a decree of God. And this is why it's a problem to violate a sin by accident. Furthermore, anything which is forbidden makes your soul dirty, and makes it impure. It says about sin that you shall become impure through it. And that's why the one who does something by accident is called a chote. Even so, you shouldn't be punished in purgatory or in destruction, but you still need to be cleansed and to purify yourself and to sanctify yourself to be worthy of reward in the world to come. And therefore God has mercy on his people and on his righteous ones, his pious ones. So God gave us karbanot to get atonement for accidental sin. So the Ramban raises these two possibilities. That accidental sin, we have to ask the exact same question. Right? Is it that the reason we're punished for accidental sin is because there's something objective, metaphysical going on when I violate sin? Or is it that just like by sins on purpose, you're punished because you rebelled against God, so accidental sins, you're punished because you were flippant and you weren't careful enough? And that itself requires atonement. The Ran has a line to describe the second possibility. Right? He gives the mashal. He says that if all the doctors in the world would tell you that a food was not poisonous, but it was, and then you went and ate it, right, it would kill you, right? And sin is like that. In the metaphysical world, it has a negative, you know, effect on your soul, which is real. And no matter what happens, right, no matter why you violated it, it's going to affect you, which is the second possibility of the Ramban. The first possibility is that, no, you're being punished because you didn't care enough about what God said. So that is sort of the background. So we have these ideas that sin really has two components to it, the action component and the intent component, and that each of them at some level are sinful. This leads to, right now, right, we switch gears from philosophy to halacha, right? Now, how does this get from right here to the question of doctors and soldiers switching shifts? So, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and this is in Source 3, says something incredible. And he says like this. He says in a few places. This is actually the one where he connects it directly to our Gemara. So this is Rav Neuwirth quoting Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. V'shamati me'agon Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. That's all. So I heard from Rav Shlomo Zalman. D'nira d'adif tvei lasas ha'malach al yidei shomer mitzvos shekavanaso le'mitzvah. If you have to violate Shabbos. Now he's talking about medical issues. It's better for a shomer Shabbos person to violate Shabbos to save somebody's life. Why? Ki al yidei avarion. Because if a sinner, meaning someone who's not shomer Shabbos, were to violate Shabbos to save someone on Shabbos, asher kavanaso rak avur betza kesef. Right here, he has a very cynical view of doctors, which we can argue about in a moment. But this is just work with his assumption for a minute, right? That they're working as doctors to make money. So afal gav dekavid mitzvah, even though he is doing a mitzvah, mikol makom, since he doesn't know that, right, he's not having in mind that, oh, normally I keep Shabbos, but now I'm doing it for pikuach nefesh. I'm doing it because you're allowed to violate Shabbos to save lives. So it's like the Gemara's case where you intend to do something prohibited and you end up doing something permitted. Meaning he has the intent of sin without the action of sin. And therefore, if the Shomer Shabbos, you were to switch with him, he would violate Lifnei Iver, because you're causing him to sin by simply allowing him to engage in something which he thinks is prohibited, right? Because his perspective isn't going to be, oh, it's Shabbos, and I would normally not violate Shabbos, but I'm going to violate Shabbos here because there's an exception because to save a life. He's going to say, look, I don't care about Shabbos, i.e. Avera. So by you letting him doing it, by letting him, quote-unquote, sin, you're violating Lifnei Iver, the prohibition to cause someone else to sin. V'gam efsher d'menina d'idon gvar tvei. And maybe here it's even worse. Kevin Shemes yesh kan chil Shabbos, because in order to save the life, he has to violate Shabbos. V'itachen sherofein nechshav keinu mechal Shabbos, rakim kamanasu la'atzala. And it could be that you're only considered not violating Shabbos if you have intent to save and to fulfill the mitzvah of pikuach nevesh. V'lo im mechavein l'tashlom. And not if you're just doing it because you're focused on your salary, you're focused on payment. So the Rav Shlomo Zalman takes our Gemara and then translates it into halacha. And he says, wait a second. You see that the Gemara calls the intent to sin, sin. Then he makes a sociological assumption, right? Psychological assumption, which is that people who are not from and don't keep Shabbos normally don't have this cognizance of Bikuach Nefesh. With that assumption, he therefore says, if a from Jew is going to violate Shabbos, so then he knows that it's permitted for pikuach nefesh, and therefore it's permitted, it's a mitzvah. If the not from Jew does it, then he just thinks, I don't care about Shabbos, I'm violating Shabbos, because I don't care about Shabbos. So that's considered a form of chilul Shabbos, so therefore you're obligated to not switch shifts with him, because if you switch shifts with him, right, then you're making him violate Shabbos, even though in reality he's not, you're making him intend to violate Shabbos, and that's sufficient to make it prohibited. Now,
Why does he need to introduce the money part?
Yeah. Well,
why does he need to introduce the money part in it?
Because so why does that work? So now, the simplest way, without even getting to halachic argument to the Shlomo Zalman, is to assume that his assumption about the, you know, altruistic nature of doctors or lack thereof is not true. Right? I mean, all you have to say is that, right, he assumes that the doctor, the not from doctor, isn't doing it to say, right, his first priority is not, you know, to save a life.
So let's talk about soldiers. Why doesn't he talk about soldiers?
I mean, this just happens to be the context. It's the exact same halachic question.
No, because
right?
Then you don't have a question of money. The money dilutes the whole.
I mean, they get paid too, right? Or they're, but they could be doing it for, you know, nationalism and not for pikuach nefesh, right? You could come up with, you know, all types of things, but. But you're right that the first question you need to deal with before you even get to the halachic claim he makes is he right, right, psychologically? And if you think no, right, if you think, as I think most people assume, that not all doctors, but many doctors or most doctors also have this notion that there's a value to saving life. So they may not know the halachic term pikuach nefesh, but they have this sort of intuitive grasp of the notion that...
Well, the Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah, and that human life is supreme, and that we try to save it, and that's an ethical value.
They get paid anyway. He gets paid because they switch with another day. It doesn't matter. He gets paid anyway monthly. It's not by
right. And we assume that, you know, people have in mind when they're going, you know, that when they go into the medical profession, right? They know they're getting a salary, but they're going in for a certain. And yeah, I mean, they're going to be paid for tomorrow, you know. So one could simply argue in Rosh Zalman's, you know, sort of psychological assumption and say everyone has some sort of vague notion of pikuach nefesh. Call it pikuach nefesh, call it whatever you want, but everyone has intent for a mitzvah. They may not realize that, you know, the formalities of you're not allowed to violate Shabbos normally, but here you're allowed to violate Shabbos. So the first way to argue in Rosh Zalman is just to say his psychological assumption is incorrect, in which case the argument falls apart. But even if the psychological assumption is true, he still is predicated on another assumption, which is that when we take this Gemara and we say, what is the main component of sin? He isolates one component and says that the intent to sin is enough, as you see in the Gemara, of a sin that that would be considered Chilul Shabbos, right? Without him actually being cognizant of the fact that it's mutter that it's permitted to violate Shabbos to save somebody's life, even though he's doing a mitzvah objectively, it would be considered violation of Shabbos, and therefore he thinks a frum doctor should actively not switch his shift. And the same presumably would be true of this soldier. The psychological assumptions might be different, but the halachic claim would be the same. However, this is extremely problematic. Because if you look in 4, right, and this is what was pointed out by Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, who's Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's son-in-law, right, and a current very prominent posek in Israel. So he points out that the Gemara in Menachos sounds not this way at all. The Gemara in Menachos sounds like this, that Itmar, Shama Shetava Tinok Bayam, if you heard that a child was drowning, Uparas Mitsuda Alalos Dagim Ve'ala Dagim, and then you happen to go fishing, and you get fish in your net, so chayiv. You violate, and this is on Shabbos, so you violate the prohibition of hunting. Lahalos dagim behela tinok vidagim. But let's say you went fishing. You were intending to violate Shabbos, but your net catches not just the fish, but catches the baby. So then, what's the halacha? So Rabba says patur. Rabba says you're exempt. Rava amar chayev, and Rava says you're liable. Rabba amar pater. Rava says you're exempt. Kazil basar maisav. Go by his actions. What did he do? What he actually did was pikuach nefesh. He saved a life, and therefore, even though yes, he was also violating Shabbos, the halacha is that pikuach nefesh is doche Shabbos, right? Saving a life knocks away Shabbos, and therefore, if you look at the action and what he did was he saved a life, so then he's exempt. V'rav amar chayev zil basar machshavto, and Rava says he's liable. Go by his intent. So Zalman Yechemia Goldberg says, well, wait a second. You think that the relevant category, both for doing a mitzvah and for violating an aveira, in the case of pikuach nefesh, is intent, and therefore you say that what's important is does the person know that it's permitted for him to violate Shabbos or not? But the Gemara explicitly says the opposite, because we paskin like Rabba, right? The Gemara we've played out this dispute. Rava says that by pikuach nefesh, by saving a life, what matters is your intent, and you need to intend to save a life. And if you don't, you're violating Shabbos. But Rabba says the opposite. Rabba says we don't look at intent, we look at the actions. What did you do? Facts on the ground. Did you violate Shabbos or did you save a life? And we say you saved a life, and therefore it's permitted. And the Beis Yitzchak, this Rav Yitzchak Shmelkes in 5, says, now it's not that this Gemara is weighing in and saying that all we ever care about is your actions. It's saying specifically, umashma delamandim or pater ein kan shum chiyuv. It sounds like here the one who says exempt, there's no liability at all. Vav makos mardus kishazim ezid pater. There isn't even rabbinic lashes when you did this. Why is that? So he says nirali atam disham bin eskavein. Lidvar avera v'asa mitzvah poter ligamrei masha einkein miskavin lidvar avera v'asa davar shos chayev makas mardos. So he creates a middle position. He says, "Well, look, it's not that we only care about actions. Right? We clearly do care about intent. Right? The Gemara in Kiddushin and in Nazir make it clear that if you mean to do something wrong and you know that is problematic. But he says, but if you mean to do something wrong, so if you mean to do something wrong, you end up doing something neutral. So we can call that a sin. Because what do we look at the action, right? The woman who ate the food thinking it was prohibited. Thinking it was prohibited, but it was permitted. Right? So it's a neutral act, but there's intent to violate an avera. So that we can call sin. But he said, but if there's a mitzvah involved, then you have two competing factors. You have intent to violate an avera, but you have a fact on the ground that you did a mitzvah. So Rav Yitzchak Shmelka says, in that case, the facts on the ground will override your intent, and the fact that you saved a life will nullify the bad intentions, because it may be true that there is an element of sin that hangs simply on your intent, but the more important element is the facts on the ground, at least when there's a countervailing factor. So Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg argues back against Rav Shlomo Zalman and says, your whole assumption is based on this legal presumption that the only thing that matters is intent. But if you look at the Gemara, at least when you've actually accomplished a mitzvah, you've actually saved a life, we don't care how you got there. We don't care if you had bad intent. We focus on actions and not intent. And Ramosha Feinstein, without...
Isn't that going against what we learned in the beginning of the Gemara? That's saying...
Like, so that's what the Beis Yitzchak is trying to solve, is that in the Gemara's case, it's you're doing a neutral act with bad intent. In the Gemara in Menachos' case, the case of saving the life, you're intending to violate an Avera,
but
you don't do a neutral act, you do a positive act, right? So what he argues is, it may be true that there are two components to sin. There's intent and there's action. So if you intend to sin and do something neutral, so then we can call that a sin, a partial sin. Or if you do something objectively forbidden without the intent, so we can call that a partial sin. But if you intend to sin and end up doing a mitzvah, right? So now those two components aren't just two different components, they're competing components, right? Because your actions tell you that you saved a life. Your intent tells you you violated Shabbos, right? And the Gemara here is telling you, right, that where Rabbah and Rav are really arguing about this point is when it's not just isolated components, but when in fact the two components are against each other, which prevails. So Rava says that your intent still prevails, and Rava says your actions prevail. And so Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, and Beis Yitzchak point out, Beis Yitzchak doesn't put it out for Rav Shlomo Zalman, but Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg actually pointed out for Rav Shlomo Zalman that his intent, his assumption, we always go by intent, even when the factors compete, right? Where it's not negative intent or negative action, but it's positive action with negative intent. That seems to go against the way we rule in the Gemara. So therefore, they argue back and say, what are you talking about? How can you say that the guy is violating Shabbos? He's not violating Shabbos. He's saving a life. I don't care about intent. He's violating Shabbos. And based on that type of argument, Rav Moshe Feinstein goes even farther in source 6, and he says, V'yesh tam gadol lahatir afim yehudim she'enem shomrei Torah shegam kishi yashiru beveisa michalu Shabbos b'mezed v'chol malachot she'iz damein lo pachot memalachot she'yaz v'et cholim be'isr shim ken ein bazeh lefnei iver bazeh she'ochlu lehu malachot b'malachot. And Moshe said, right, well, once we're going by actions, so it's not just that you don't have to switch, or you should switch, because think about it. The frum Jew is going to go home and he's going to keep Shabbos. The not from Jew, if he's at home, so he doesn't keep Shabbos, so what's he going to do? His actions will be unjustified. If he's in the hospital, so sure he'll be violating Shabbos, but he'll be violating Shabbos
to save life.
So if you're looking at the facts on the ground, it's not you're not making it worse off, you're making him better off. So it seems like you're making him do less things wrong. Because many people in the hospital, maybe not all of them, are actually dying. But there are many cases where it actually is pikuach nefesh. And a lot of the things you do are only the prohibition against refuah, against healing, which is only rabbinic anyways. And what he does at home could be biblical. So Rav Moshe takes this type of argument and says, wait a second, if we're looking at actions and not intent, so it's not just that you shouldn't switch, you should dafka switch, because then, you know, you'll go home, you'll keep Shabbos, you'll have your Shabbos meals, and he'll do the great mitzvah, pikuach nefesh.
Yeah, but the frum Jew is going to also do pikuach nefesh.
It's true, but now if you look at these two people after Shabbos, what happened? Right, the frum Jew, if the frum Jew switches with him, so the frum Jew will go home and keep Shabbos, and the not frum Jew will be in the hospital and will have violated Shabbos. It'll be permitted for him to do it. If they don't switch, then the frum Jew will be mekayim pikuach nefesh, which is a great thing, but the not frum Jew will be home
and doing
malachot. So Moshe, if you just look at actions, right, there's an argument in the opposite direction. Switch. Give him the opportunity to do good things, even if he doesn't realize it. But he's doing better things in the hospital than he does at home.
It's like the same rationale. Let's say people are saying people are driving to shul. At least the 3 or 4 hours that he's in shul is mekayim.
Right, it's part of the argument that people make. Now, Ramosha actually doesn't like that one. Ramosha actually think that's prohibited. But that is part of the argument other people make, not Ramosha himself. Ramosha was very, very harsh with that and didn't like it at all. Right, so now we have this dispute, right? We have Rosh Shlomo Zalman focusing on intent and therefore saying you should avoid switching because you'll do it for the right reasons and he might not. Which, like we said, we can argue on the psychological assumptions. But even if we agree with the psychological assumptions, he's making a very large halachic claim that mitzvot and aver all go by intent. And then Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, the Beis Yitzchak, and Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon, who spoke at Shara Shemayim, if anyone was there just recently, right on Sunday night, and he was up at the Bayit as well. We had lunch with him, right? The Rav in Alon Shvud. So he points to this Beis Yitzchak to support the soldier switching. They argue back that at least when a mitzvah is being done, we care less about intent and more about the actions on the ground. So here we have two sort of diametrically opposed positions. One which says that we should endorse switching, we should actively switch. The other one saying we should actively avoid switching. In source 7, Rav Shlomo Minahar, who is the current rabbi in Israel, says something which goes in a completely different direction, which to me is astonishing. And I can't accept, but it's important just to see it. He claims that you should switch, but for a totally different reason. So there's a rule in general on Shabbos, that when you violate Shabbos for pikuach nefesh, if it's not going to actually delay the saving of a life, so you should try to avoid doing it in the most strict way possible, or the most stringent way possible. So if you have the option of violating a rabbinic law or a biblical law, and it's not going to delay you, so then you go with the rabbinic law. Right? That's a general rule, that if you're going to violate it, so always go with the lesser law. So now he comes up with this very interesting claim. I bring it up really to contrast it with 8. But he says like this, "B'she'ilat ha'achlafa misha mechal Shabbat bekvi'ut." Regarding someone who switching with someone who is always a Mechal Shabbos, ani mevochaz deshanim rabot. I've been confused about this for many years, because midivrei haramban ani lo meid. Because I think based on the Ramban, shekol atzibor kayom who shogeg beinav b'kol masho said, the non-orthodox community are considered accidental sinners. Leficha chayan nireh shemitzvah tamid legalgel et melacha b'shabbat b'mikre shel pikuach nefesh al mi shemechalel shabbato tamid. So therefore, I think you should always switch to cause the Shabbos violators to work to do the pikuach nefesh on Shabbos. Sharei zeh sheyodeh sheyom Shabbos, the one who knows that it's Shabbos v'shino sinat Torah tziva ala Shabbos, and that God commanded about Shabbos, nidrash atam mishum pikuach nefesh litchodeh Shabbat shel b'mezid. If he violates Shabbos to save a life, he's violating Shabbos on purpose to save a life. Shehu isur chamur sheish b'mizu kares, and that's a really big sin. It's permitted, but it's a big sin he has to push away. Lumadzo zesh eini yodeh, but this one who doesn't know that it's prohibited, b'neishu mumar ushogi, because he's an accidental sinner, nidrash l'chodesh shabbat shelo, he has to violate his Shabbos, davar shu etzlo rakets or shogig shechayev alav shchatas, and his Shabbos to begin with was only ever considered accidental. His Shabbos violations were only accidental. So it's clear that if you could violate Shabbos stringently or more leniently, you should do it more leniently. Amnam, then he just says, there's only when there's peace, right? He's talking about the soldier switching. By war, when there's emergencies, so don't switch. Because you get too used to switching. Then you'll easily come to danger because you'll be looking for other people. So we'll leave that last point, right? He says, if it's going to actually cause danger, don't do it. But he makes an astonishing claim, right? Because normally when people think about it, they say, what is the prohibition on the ground that's being violated? And what is the mitzvah that's being done? And how do they work together? He says, wait a second. I'm going to say that since non-Orthodox Jews, we generally consider them tinok shenishba, we consider them shogeg, we consider them accidental sinners, that means that whenever he violates Shabbos, it's just considered an accidental sin. And therefore, it transforms his violation of Shabbos into a lesser sin than mine. And therefore, I should actively switch, because he is, so to speak, a different type of Jew. So his violation of Shabbos is not as bad. She should switch, because his Shabbos is of a lesser level.
So going back to the metaphysical, he just throws the whole thing away.
Yeah, right. He totally walks away from this recognition of sin and takes a different approach and says, well, you know, this real solution here is that there are two types of Jews, right? Because since we generally treat non-religious Jews as tinok shenishba, we say that it's not their fault and it's a shogeg, and that means that forever their Shabbos is of a lesser level.
It's also a slippery slope because he's being very relative, like he's relativizing. So it's,
yeah.
So where do you end?
Once right, and this is the logical problem. He's saying, oh, their Shabbos is less valuable, right? So I brought that in to contrast it with the Heichal Yitzchak, who says, don't switch and don't not switch, right? Just whatever comes, the luck of the draw, whatever it happens to be, take it. Why? So he says, and this is an 8, so Heichal Yitzchak is Rav Yitzchak Herzog, so he was the chief rabbi of Israel. Right, so this is an important perspective. And he's like this, Ad kan dibarti rav mechinat halacha. So far I've talked about halacha. Aval yish gam tzarach her linyan zeh. But there's something else here. If we make these switches between religious and non-religious Jews, it's as if we are totally fine with this, that there are two types of Jews, religious Jews and non-religious Jews. Religious Jewry and non-religious Jewry, or religious Judaism and non-religious Judaism. But we should feel upset that there are people violating sin. And we should pray that God should bring them back. They should believe God of Torah Chayim and Shemana Shemayim and believe in the Torah, Yashiv Levot al Banim, Velev Banim al Avotam, and bring them back, Vaharbe Yesh Lachush Ledati, and I'm worried, Shemisidurim Kaila, that for switching like this, Yivatzer Haroshem, it'll seem, Kilu Kfar Hityashnu Mehem, Venichalanu, it'll look like we already gave up on them, and it's okay, Chas V'Shom, God forbid, Shu Shabbat, Goyim Kiilu Heim Hivkarnum Yeush Vevker Gechar, and they should be our Shabbos Goyim, because we've given up on them, right? So he says, don't switch. Right? Don't dafka switch, don't dafka not switch. Because the second you start making the switches, you're implying that you like this situation, that halacha takes into account, oh, they're religious Jews and not religious Jews. And what these last two sources, you know, sort of assume, which we haven't spelled out until now, is that this whole question really presumes that halacha can ask the question, what type of Jew should do it? A frum Jew or a not frum Jew? But Rav Herzog is challenging and saying no, because halacha never asked that question, because from the perspective of halacha, everyone should be keeping the Torah, and if you don't, that's unfortunate. So we can't make these calculations. So the second you make this calculation, even in Ramosha's direction, right, we make the calculation, we say, oh, well, it'll protect him from violating Shabbat. Still, that means you're saying, oh, there's from Jews and they're not from Jews. No, that may be the reality, but that's not how halacha works. Halacha looks at the ideal. We don't want it to be that way. There's one type of Jew, and if we believe Torah is true, then we hope that everyone will be there. But halacha can't make these calculations, right? Which is the polar opposite of Shlomo Menahar, who says that halacha has so accepted these divisions, right, that their Shabbos is less, you know, worthwhile than ours. We should always switch with them because it's not such a big deal, right? So this question of switching right? Now in Israel, the big one is switching soldiers. In America, it's more switching with doctor shifts in hospitals. But the same question, right? And there's two sort of big questions, philosophical, sociological questions that motivate this halachic debate. The first one that we saw is the question of when we're analyzing sin and mitzvah, what do we really care about, intent or action? And you have Rosh Hashanah Zalman saying we care about intent and making assumptions about what they intend. And you have Rav Moshe and Rav Zalman Nechemia, Beis Yitzchak and Rav Yad saying, no, what we care about at least when there's a mitzvah involved is, right, what happened, facts on the ground. If a mitzvah happened, we don't care. And therefore we should, Rav Shlomo Zalman says you actively shouldn't switch. And then Rav Moshe says you actively should. The assumption underlying all these positions, the unstated assumption, is that halacha is sort of, at some level, recognize the difference between Shomer Shabbos Jews and not Shomer Shabbos Jews, which comes to its extreme in Rosh Shlomo Menahar, saying that their Shabbos is not worthwhile, and therefore we should always give it to them, because big deal. Or he says big deal, but it's not as big of a deal, right? And then you have the last position, the Heichal Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Herzog, saying, no, we've missed the boat. This whole discussion is very interesting philosophically, but it only gets off the ground if you think you can even start making these calculations. But since these calculations presume that there's two types of Jews, and halacha doesn't really believe that, there's one type of Jew, and doing this is, as he said, making them into our Shabbos Goyim, right? Then you shouldn't switch, you shouldn't not switch, the luck of the draw, just go with it, because, right, the question never gets off the ground because the entire assumption of the question is flawed. Now, I will note that Herzog, I have a theory about this piece in Herzog, which I have no way of proving, because this piece in Herzog is very nice, but it's actually not the first piece in Herzog, because Herzog had a different tshuva, an earlier tshuva, where he was asked, how can we set up police forces on Shabbos in Israel? And there he says that we should, I don't have to answer the question. Like he gives a theoretical background. He says, well, I think we should, you know, these are theoretically what I would say, but I don't have to answer the question at the end of the day because, look, let's be real, right? It's 1950, whatever it was, early 1950s, and there are a lot of people who are not from, and they're not going to listen to me anyways, and from Jews aren't really in the police force, so, you know, when it becomes relevant, you know, come back to me and I'll make hard and fast decisions. This is what my speculations, but I don't think that I need to make a decision. And Rav Shaul Yisraeli wrote a tshuva where he attacked Rav Herzog and said, how can you say that? Right? You can't make an argument like that because the job of a posek is to recognize that we need to paskin for the nation. And this is not the ideal. If an ideal halachic state needs a police force, then you need to come up with a way that a police force can exist on Shabbos, even if everyone would overnight become a Baal Tshuva and would keep Shabbos. You can't duck the question and say, well, it's not relevant. No, that your responsibility is to aim for the ideal, is to say, we want it that halacha can function in society, even when everyone is doing what they should be doing. Don't come to terms with the situation, right? That's not how halacha works. My guess is that Rav Herzog took that, because this tshuva, which is later, yeah, right, he echoes sort of that critique of Yisraeli. And it wasn't just like they were talking, you know, like they both issued tshuva. There was a dialogue between Rav Herzog and Rav Shaul Yisraeli and the Tzitzel Eliezer and like all the poskim in the time in the 50s. So my guess is that he accepted at some level the critique of Yisraeli, and actually had gone through, right, had gone from the first sort of model to the second sort of model after that moment. I can't prove it, but it does work out with the years of the tshuva. Anyway, so I think this topic is fun because the first half of it shows how, you know, what seems to be philosophical issues, right? What is the nature of sin, nature of mitzvah, can in fact be, you know, a halachic data point. And the second half of it is, right, a more sociological question, is halacha affected by our assumptions of how we treat people? Do we play and paskin towards the ideal, or do we work with the data at hand, even if it presumes a reality that halacha doesn't really recognize in its purest form? And I think those two questions, you know, we sort of think of as, you know, broad philosophical, sociological claims, but what you see here in Poskim is that they have real consequences, because how you think both about the nature of sin philosophically and you think of how halacha sociologically deals with people who aren't in an ideal situation, both end up affecting how they actually poskin hard and fast halacha questions, both in terms of switching for doctors and switching for soldiers. So I always find it to be an interesting topic, just because it, you know, it takes sort of these meta questions and grounds them in a very sort of concrete way. And like I said, these questions come up on a day-to-day basis. Like the piece I quoted from in Rav Yosef Tzvi Maon is, he has a little tiny book called Hilchot Tzava, which is a handbook which soldiers are reading out there in the field. Right? It's meant to be the summary halachot for people who don't have books with them to look at questions when they're literally in battle. And he quotes this Beis Yitzchak as part of his tshuva, because, you know, these, like, you know, huge meta questions, how do you view sin, are what, you know, 19-year-olds are dealing with in Israel, because day in, day out, they have to figure out, do I switch, right? Do I not switch? If I'm in a, you know, mixed unit, what do I do, right? So these big questions suddenly hit home for these, you know, 19-year-olds out there in the field, which I think is a striking thing. You know, the doctor thing is a little bit more planned, right? You know, you know where you're going to medical school, you know if you're going to a Shomer Shabbos residency, you know, and all my friends, before they went, wherever they went, if they went to a Shomer Shabbos residency or not Shomer Shabbos residency, they, you know, asked their questions in advance and they had a plan. But like, soldiers are doing this, you know, day in, day out. The fact that they have to think of these, you know, questions, that it has a meaningful impact on what they do, to me is always striking. So I like this topic because it sort of brings a different perspective to halacha. Okay.
I think also maybe by switching from religious to non-religious, it may cause a chilul Hashem, because the non-religious can say, what is this? I want to go to
the beach. There's definitely all, you know, also ancillary factors. It'll cause chilul Hashem, it'll cause hatred, right? You know, oh, how does he get privileges? Exactly. And
especially when the non-religious doesn't understand the whole principle about saving life is a mitzvah and stuff like that. So,
right, and you know, and you know, people come up with ways. You know, I know, you know, I remember once one of my good friends, one of the madrichim when I was in yeshiva, he said that, like, it does create animosity sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, the religious soldiers, forget Shabbos for a moment, but other times, the religious soldiers will get, you know, on Purim night, they get an hour or whatever it is to go read the Megillah. Half hour to go read the Megillah. It says it'll cause animosity. So one, you know, thing you could do is you could say, well, okay, there's nothing we can do. It causes animosity, right? Or you could say, okay, well, then maybe we shouldn't go and say we're exempt. But there's a third option, which is to say,
you give everybody half an hour and that's it.
Yeah. So he likes telling the story that he was in the middle of a sharpshooting contest on Tainus Esther. And as nightfall was coming, he was winning, right? And then, like, nightfall came, and now was their time. So he was willing to throw the contest, because he said, you know, like, I'm winning the sharpshooting contest, but he was willing to throw it, but like, there was a few minutes left, but he had to get there, the Megillah. But he said, instead of, you know, everyone, you know, saying, oh, what's this religious Jew doing, the Chilonim were so, you know, impressed that, on the one, you know, in the morning, he was, you know, the top sharpshooter, but was willing to throw his title to go take his half-hour break and go do it, that they all said, we're going to go hear Megillah, so it ended the contest, so he ended up winning, but they all went with him, right? You know, he didn't try to impose on anybody. He said, you know what, I'm going to give up my title because it's important to me. It's not, I'm not taking a privilege, I'm giving up something, right, and inspire them, and they came with him, right? So there is that other option, which is to try to, you know, not say, oh, I'm going to switch and you take it, but to, you know, bring people in and try to make them want to join you, which is the other, you know, sort of component of it, which is the Kiddush Hashem component, the inspiring people to be better themselves and things like that, which are, you know, other sort of factors that do play into it. But that's, you know, a much broader question. Okay.